because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach, welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Coach, is a real treat for us today. Will Weaver here, the new coach of the NBL Sydney Kings. And last year, the 2018-19 NBA G League Coach of the Year. And coach, great pedigree in terms of your background, which I'm sure we'll get into as well. But on your way as a head coach to great success already. So welcome to the podcast.
Chris, thank you. Such a fan of the podcast and a big fan of yours. So I appreciate you having me on.
Well, thanks, Coach. And let's start somewhere maybe a little bit different for coaches, but I know you had a newborn recently, 7 months. We talked a little bit just before we came on. And I just thought what you were saying about this is necessary for coaches to hear. And if I have it right, that your newborn was, or your son?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, was born in October, right at the beginning of the season. Can you talk about that and how you've learned how to balance all that?
Yeah, I've always been a pest to parents that I respect. And of all the things I've kept organized, my sort of notes from those conversations over the years probably is the best effort I've made. And so a big part of that was, you know, obviously seeing other guys serve as a head coach while being a dad and a husband in a way that I really respect and admired. And I'm lucky that, you know, the guys I've worked with, every single one of them, Rick Barnes and Jason Hooten and Kenny Atkinson and Brett Brown, Andre Lemonis, that they all have created a lot of space in their life to focus on dadding and husbanding to an extent that I think is maybe different than what the stereotype is of coaches. And I think all, you know, a lot of guys appreciate that there's a lot of work to do and that it's a 24-hour job if you let it be that. But it was important to me to make sure that in this first year as a professional head coach and as a first year as a dad, that I always kept my eye on the prize and I tried to make sure that my time reflected my values. And so if I was going to be a little unprepared for anything or short shrift anything, it was going to be a practice plan or a scouting report rather than the other way around. And really, I think that protected me from those feelings of guilt or those feelings of those misgivings that you sometimes have when you're trying to achieve quote unquote family life balance.
Well, it's so refreshing to hear and so necessary for all of us to hear, because I agree. I mean, my daughters are 6 and 8 now, and they've been a part of every step of my career and my coaching, and they come to as many practices as possible. And, you know, even if they disrupted practice when they were younger, I still felt like the most valuable thing I was doing was modeling parenting to my players. You know, so at least they saw what it's really like, and they ended up learning, and you put them in those environments and kids learn. So they learn that it's not a time to disrupt, but overall it's just such an amazing experience.
So I can remember so vividly, you know, conversations happening really early in my career when I was trying to get engaged as a volunteer somewhere, or when I was a graduate student at Texas and looking for assistant jobs, and, you know, getting the specific advice about I really wouldn't share that you're in this long-term relationship. Like, I would keep that private if I were you. You know, guys are going to look at that. You know, they're looking for grinders. They're looking for guys who are going to be in the office. The last thing they want to do is think that you're going to be, you know, your priorities are going to be split. And I just always felt like it was such a advantage for me to have the grounding kind of person in my life that my wife is. And it seemed like, I don't know, certainly when I was single, I don't think it was a good thing for my work. I don't think it did provide me a lot of energy, and that's probably different for different people, but I felt like I had a lot more distractions in that part of my life. And so I think the having a child and what it does for you, I have a different level of appreciation for the players that I've coached and the coaches I've worked with who've gone on this journey. And that's obviously a huge part of life. And so I feel like if anything, it's given me more tools and more experience and more sympathy and appreciation for the role that someone in our business plays as a husband and a dad.
Well, that's great to hear. And the stereotype of coaching certainly, I hope, is changing. And that's the fact that we don't have to go hashtag grinding. We can just be really efficient and really effective with our time, which I'm guessing you are and many really successful people are. It's not this perception of 24 hours. It's just that when you work, you're really effective and efficient. So
I'd also like to share, my wife had so many graduations. She's a child neurologist. And so I feel like I've been to 9 of these damn degree commencement type things, right? Which you can hear, everyone loves. Nothing's more fun than sitting in an auditorium. But my expectations were so low. And the speaker at, I think, the 6th of 8 was so impressive because she said something that will stay with me forever. And that it was this idea of balance is a myth. This idea that like your husband's going to spend 50% of his time on work and 50% of his time on children. And you're going to spend 50% of your time and 50%. And that will equal 100%. And your kids will be perfectly nourished emotionally and developmentally, and your job will totally appreciate it. You can climb just as fast as everybody else. It's just such madness. But if you don't spend time to think about it, you might not appreciate that you can decide as a family, hey, I'm going to be spending a little more time on the career now. And that means that I'm going to need more support from you with the family and vice versa. And so having a partner that has her own career and a objectively more valuable one to the world than mine, it's always served as an opportunity for me to reflect, especially at the beginning, before you take a job, like, all right, what does our family's pie chart look like for the coming several months? And, if it's about to be hot and heavy for me, then there needs to be a valley for me to give to the family a little bit so that it's not just an 8-month slog for her and vice versa. So that's served us really well. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to listen to all those graduation speakers, because that one alone made it worth it.
Oh, it's super to hear. Super to hear. Take things from anywhere. That's the beautiful part about coaching life and parenting and all these other things. So coach, let's get into basketball a little bit, moving into the Sidney Kings job, but obviously reflecting on all the other experiences. You've mentioned this before in a conversation that I read, and that's how to coach in a modern way. What does that mean nowadays when we talk about coaching in a modern way?
I think that coaches have always been symbolically important, and I think that the extent to which coaches are identified, they're oftentimes the most identifiable, they have the longest life with a program, and for those reasons, they get sort of held up more than they should, and they bear more responsibility and get more credit and get more blame, and can sometimes slip into that role if you thought of it as a play. And I think that more and more, as an industry, we're distancing ourselves from that. And that's the good thing, because it's hard to be an actor and a teacher and a mentor and a good colleague. Like, it takes energy to put on those kinds of behaviors that you think you're supposed to do. So one way is just simply, I think, appreciating what our role is. And it might be different depending on the organization, but if you really understand, okay, in our organization, what is my role, then you can apportion time to it strategically. And so for me and the places I've been, Long Island as an example, my role was to help create an environment where our players could grow. And there were players that there was going to be more focus on from the Brooklyn decision-making apparatus because of how much we invested in them. But every player needed the opportunity to make as quick a strides as they could. And so that was my job. And so I spent time trying to organize what we did and what I did to allow for that.
It's great. And it raises something that I've talked to G League coaches. It's almost like a social experiment. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is dealing with the role players, because there's almost a clear separation between the two-way players that are maybe going back and forth, and then the players that aren't quite getting that opportunity. And being able to connect with those players to keep them engaged, to keep them focused on their goals, but also the team goals. What are some of the things that you found successful in that way? Because I think those things apply to all coaches at all levels.
Hire great people. It's pick the right wife, hire the right people, tiers under themselves in terms of importance in being successful, and a big gap probably between 2 and 3, right? Sign the right players. In Brooklyn, we there's a real emphasis on the humans that we're bringing in and what their skill sets are, of course, is a relevant part of that. But our, you know, role players, as you referred to them as, all of them were guys that truly did care if we won or lost. And that might seem like a low bar, but, you know, like people behave in their own best interest usually. And it's difficult to be making one of the lowest salaries in the world playing professional basketball in one of the better leagues in the world. That is just a there's some cognitive dissonance there for guys and for staff members and for athletic trainers and all those things, but you're investing in your future. And so if you can get guys that are mature enough to understand that and recognize that there's some delayed gratification, that's a big part of the battle. And just the people that you have working with the players, right? Like if you just pick the folks that get it, and we did, you know, Ryan Forehand, Kelly, Sean Fine, Milton Palacio, Scott Simpson, Jimmy Oakman, like those guys were such a machine and they collaborated so well with each other and they were thoughtful about who needed to talk to who when and what needed to come from me and what should I stay away from. And that is everything, you know, and there's so in any season, regardless of the length, it burns pretty hot. So the intensity of it can sometimes distract the player or the coach from what the job is, but we were pretty relentless in keeping our eye on the prize. And that was, how can we generate opportunities for these guys? And some of that's going to come from our style of play, some of the, you know, making sure that it aligns with what Brooklyn's doing so that they can get a quality look at these guys. And a player like Taj McCall can get a call up because Brooklyn sees, oh, he can fit in and play with us for a set of games that we need some depth at the guard. You know, opportunities for Mitch Creek, right, where other teams, the Minnesota T-Wolves, you know, they sign him as a culture driver, you know, understanding what he did for our club. Kamari Murphy is going to go make a ton of money in Europe this year. And we've talked openly throughout the year about, you know, let me be your agent. Like, let's talk about the next half of this season like you're interviewing for jobs, because you are. So you're a switching, you know, how's your agent going to describe you? And what questions is that team going to ask? So can he hedge? Yes. Can he switch? Yes. Can he protect the rim? Yes. Can he defensive rebound? Yes. Will he roll? Yes. Can he make a three? Yeah. You know, like, let's keep working our way down the list so that your time is pointed straight. You know, the last thing you want to do is spend a period of this year worrying about your playing time or your whatever, your role. If that's not good for you, by all means, if it's good for you, go right ahead. And we're happy to let you huff and puff. But if it distracts you from what you really want, which is not a role on this team, you want a role on a great team someday in a great league with great salary, then let's try to stay focused on that.
It's great. It's really thoughtful. And I think, I hope coaches caught up on the one thing that you said is you mentioned the word humans. And that's sometimes forgotten, that we're coaching people. We're coaching humans. We're not just coaching basketball players. And again, that connection to that word, I think, is so important for coaches to understand. So really good stuff. So coach, let's talk about interventions then. What are some things that guide your thinking? Because I know you're a thoughtful person and an analytical person to a certain extent. So what are some things that have cued you to intervene or not to intervene? Let's start first with an off-the-court situation.
Well, I'll say to many people this year, the biggest learning for me, the one that I was the least prepared for, was how much of having the head coaching role requires, or you know, how much you benefit from being able to ignore stuff. You know, the temptation and a lot of the fun is that you can intervene when you want to, right? There's very little barrier for me. If I want to stop a drill or stop a film session or call timeout or anything, then I can do that. But with that comes, you know, within just a matter of days of running the gym, I really felt, oh my goodness, like I got to make sure that I am not just responding to things when I see them, because then you've made the choice and you can't unmake it. So I love the term intervention, right? Because it should be every decision to some degree is an intervention, or the choice not to make an intervention, and that's just as big. So if a player rolls his eyes, do I need to stop practice and address that? If a coach wasn't paying attention, do I need to stop the meeting? If I screwed something up and the play is going sideways, different than the way I wanted it to. Do I need to kind of rein it back? And what I really felt was like, well, you have the opportunity to address it in a second or a minute or a day or never. But I think a lot of times we, of course, overemphasize our own impact. And so a lot of those interventions, I think, can be about us and about showing off in the way that I spoke about earlier. It's like, oh, I have a role to play, and my role is as the font of knowledge, and all ye gather around and listen to me tell you how you should play and why that sucked and what needs to change. And that's the opposite of what I want to try to do. And so the big interventions you discuss and you beat up and you think about, all right, are we going to take this guy out of the rotation? You know, have we just run up against a situation where we feel like, look, this guy's should lose the opportunity to play for us right now. And then if so, am I going to have a lunch with him? Is he going to, you know, are we going to tell him right now? Or are we going to wait to make sure we're healthy before the game to see if that doesn't change? Like, all these kinds of things are where a good staff, of course, is pivotal, because they provide you such good perspective. And they're the ones that are connecting with those players on a level that I think it'd be inappropriate for a head coach to, in some ways. Those are the guys that have to be able to sit in front of the laptop and be at a basket one-on-one with those guys every day. And so taking a lot of cues off of them.
Yeah, it's great. And I mean, just the point that you made that it's not a coaching clinic. I mean, that's, practice is not a coaching clinic. It's a completely different approach if people just think about it that way in terms of interventions. And how much does it change from a game to a practice in terms of whether it's the amount of interventions or the type of interventions you would use, Coach?
I hope a lot. My notes to myself before the year, again and again, I had written down, like, what is the walk that I'm walking? I think you talked about modeling behavior for your kids when they visited practice as we first started talking. And, you know, the behavior that I'm modeling, that's not just a symbolic job. Like, that is something that has real relevance, I think, in any organization. And so if I want to spend a bunch of time coming down the bench and praising a player or berating a player or somewhere in between, I am not watching the game. And so is that the right thing for me to be doing? And largely, I feel like the answer is no. I think during games, my job is to try to see what's actually going on and help the group adjust and put the right people on the floor and get them the right amount of rest and call plays when appropriate and change coverages when appropriate. And I need to see what's going on. And so there's a degree to which that needs to remain front and center, because I owe it to the team. That's my job. And so there, of course, are times where you do say, hey, look, this conversation needs to happen. You know, the time is right. The importance of this is far outweighs what goes on these next few possessions. But I think the ratio for me tilts way more towards watching more and talking less, emoting way less, simply because it distracts me. It's hard to see what's going on if you're losing your mind about foul call or what just happened a few possessions ago. And more importantly, like, that's what practice is for, is like, let's go back and look and see what happened. And okay, it's 24 hours hence. Like, what did we like this shot or no? Did we like this? Was this a mistake that you could have adjusted, or were you put in a bad spot? And that's why we use film, and that's why we take and spend so much time after the fact. So let's not get lost in things we can do later and at the cost of things that we need to do now in order for us to achieve what we're trying to achieve.
Coach, I heard you say something in an article that said that basically adding up good days builds trust that we're going to get somewhere. Can you talk about that? Because I thought, you know, in a way, to frame it to your players, I thought it was just an outstanding way to be able to say it, in the sense that it's an accumulation of all those good days. Is that something that is constantly talked about, or is that just something that you use to express how you build organizationally?
So I stole the phrase completely from Brett Brown. You know,
perfect.
It was his rallying cry in a bunch of ways to the staff, to the organization, was, okay, look, the distance we need to travel as an organization from 2013 to knocking on the door of the Eastern Conference Finals like they were this year is massive. You know, it's like it's hard to fathom how vast it is. So, and on my mind, it always connected to, although of course it may have got made fun of, right? And Sam never said it, but like the whole, the process days, I was really proud that what ended up being kind of the nickname for that, the time we spent in Philly. And I think Brett was really aligned to that. And you could tell by him constantly referring to the importance of adding up good days. All that is just a process oriented approach. And it is a decision-making business. And the job that a head coach has or a GM or like everyone is just trying to make good decisions about interventions, about how to spend their time, about what to pay attention to. And so obsessing over getting things perfect is a waste and unrealistic, but coming into each day and saying, all right, what are the things we can achieve today? And what are the things we need to achieve today from that list? And trying to do that at a 90% clip, then you feel like, hey, in a week or a month, like that's going to be the right kind of approach to get us where we need to go. So in some ways it takes pressure off of any day being perfect. And in other ways it keeps your eye on the prize so that you don't waste one, you know, you don't allow your players to waste one. Like of course there's going to be a game you play crappy and you lose by a bunch, or maybe you almost lose to a team that you're better than, but that can't be okay. Like you can't just say, yeah, that's cool. That's happens from time to time. Like I think you need to try to say was it a breakdown in our preparation? Is it a breakdown in our focus? Is it a breakdown in the way we've handled the loads, the physical aspect of this thing? Did we deliver to your court? Like that kind of introspection is what it's pro sport. It's what it calls for. It calls for a high level of rigor. And flip side of that coin, right? The yin and the yang is that you can't think that there aren't going to be bad days, and you can't think that those bad days are going to kill your season, but you need to try to, you just got to limit them, and you got to try to focus more so on just the stuff you believe in and the stuff you know will help you when added up over time.
And I imagine it relates a little bit to, as you said, like the game as well, that you add up good possessions in the game. And
absolutely.
Of course, that the connection's very similar, I imagine. Is that something that was talked about as
no doubt. Sure. That's, you know, the game's transactional. We're trying to get the best shot for the Nets or the Kings or the Boomers. And we trust that getting those good shots will mean more points for us, more points for you as individuals, and more wins for us. And the other side of the floor is the exact same thing. Like, how do we keep them from getting good shots? And that one possession ends, you know, the whole kind of special forces thing, what's next? Like, all right, now I got to run back in transition. Now I got to identify who I'm matched up against. And yeah, there's for sure a sort of microcosmic value and a narrative value that is easy to understand, I hope, and kind of simple and sort of obvious. Like we're trying to do, lots of folks, you're trying to do simple things well and repeat them and trust that there's an additive benefit to doing it that way. Almost every good organization you see or study has a story like that, I think.
That's great. And Coach, maybe one last organizational thing, because I know you've been around some really good organizational people as well, but coaching staffs, it seems to be, how can we best use the talents of our coaching staff? And you mentioned you had a really good coaching staff with Long Island. That's great. You had a really good coaching staff. But also the main part is, what are some practical things that allows you to use their talents or empowers them to use theirs? What are some practical things that we should be doing with our coaching staffs?
I don't know. I think, you know, I think a lot about it. And it's super important, but I suppose the only kind of insight I have maybe is that if you have a North Star, if you have a clear direction you're pointing, and you know, if you made a list of your priorities and tiered them, right, whatever was in that top tier, that you, most decisions need to connect to that. And so the people that you bring to join you on the staff and the way that you task them with certain things and the feedback you ask for from them needs to all make sense and connect. And I think that the same goes for their careers and understanding what it is that, like, what is their individual North Star? You know, is it getting your job someday? Cool. Like, is it working somewhere else as fast as possible? Cool. Is it like, why are they doing what they're doing? And what is the obligation that you have to help them try to get there? And so if you can,
do you have those conversations with them?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot. So
it's not just a player conversation. It's a coaching staff conversation about how you can obviously help them on their journey.
And just we're going to spend a lot of time together. So what Brett Brown taught me a lot about international basketball and told me a million Australian stories and prepared me to help more when I joined the Australian national team. And that wouldn't have been something that other coaches that I'd worked with would have even discovered that I had that interest. But because Brett recognized that I did, that's what led to me volunteering with the Boomers in 2014 and has now eventually led to me moving my family to Sydney and joining a whole new league and spending 5 years coaching, having the most fun coaching that I think anybody could ever have. And that's an example. Kenny Atkinson, like, he gave me a lot of opportunity to help talk about and review the decisions we were making in game. And that's not something that maybe other coaches would have been willing to share or given access to someone that they just met a month ago. But because he was, I think that there was a level of comfortability in me taking over the G League team because we'd talked about all those situations a million times and we saw things through a similar lens. So I've been so grateful to have those mentors pay me that kindness, you know, and not just the head coaches, like the other assistants that I've worked with. And so, of course, that's my obligation and what I'm excited about. That's exciting as it is to help Thomas Wimbush make the kind of money he deserves. It's also exciting to help put one of my assistant coaches in a better position for him and his family.
It's great. And Coach, actually, by the time this will be released, a blog on this
about improving game coaching. And you just mentioned something there about you reviewing game decisions with Coach Atkinson. And I've seen this a little bit at the NBA level. I haven't seen it at a lot of other levels. Can you explain that process a little bit, just about how that works?
Probably different everywhere. But if you're reflective, and I don't know that anybody's more willing to unselfishly, in the cold light of day, try to improve. And you talk about like adding up good days. Kenny adds up great days. Like, he's relentless in his preparation and how self-critical he is and his ability to cut to what actually happened rather than tell a story about what we'd all like to have happened is, I think, elite. So in that specific example, we would take the last, you know, the sort of key last segment of the game and maybe even of quarters, you know, places where you have more opportunities to intervene on the game as a coach. And we would try to point out things that, hey, look, given what we knew at the time, would we make this decision the same way? And mostly the answer is yes. And so you ignore those clips, but the ones where you'd say, man, I think I'd make a different decision here. Why? You know, all right, well, it's because of the time and score and our odds of winning. And I think we could have been more aggressive here. And yeah, it worked out, but I don't think it should have. And so what do you think? You know? Yeah, no, I agree. I think you're right. We should have drawn up a play for a three there instead of what we did, or we should have subbed differently. And so by doing that, you know, the NBA is, it's so fun to have so many opportunities to just in terms of games, because there's just so many opportunities to learn and so many opportunities to try things. And so we spent a lot of time doing that in the early days, and I know he still does it. And all the best coaches I've been around have an exceptionally generous and self-critical energy around what's gone on in the games that have occurred. And man, is this a theme? Like, is this something that we need to address with the players, or is this just something that I can do change on my own? And if we're going to do it with the players, practice time's limited. What has the most value? You know, what's the best, where's the most ROI on our practice time? And okay, it seems like this last shot scenario is coming up a lot. So let's address it.
Well, it's great because it's actually one of my arguments is that in the NBA level, obviously you get way more games than any other level. So you have more chance to develop game coaching than you would at other levels. So the importance of practice at these other levels becomes the part that you have to, again, try and be self-critical and put yourself in game situations to be able to improve just because you don't get the game reps as you would in the NBA. So
yeah, games are everything. I think, you know, of course I view it that way in part because I've been a part of so many games in the last few years with the NBA stuff and then obviously the international stuff in the offseason. But I think that the hour and a half of drills and 20 minutes of 5-on-5 at the end ain't it. I think that
Well, you know, I don't think that's it either.
And there's just tons of evidence, right? Like,
yeah.
There's tons of evidence that's not how people learn. There's tons of evidence that's not what people enjoy. And so if you want to be successful and you want to take advantage of what has been shown to work across disciplines, then applying that evidence to how you coach and how you doctor, you know, in my wife's case, like that is the way of the future. And too long sports have been exempt from demonstrating that they are somehow different or exempt from the rules of motor learning and physiology. And so it's up all of our jobs to try to benefit from our competitors that still work that way and apply the things that have been learned in business and economics and pedagogy, like across the board. Like that's what we should be doing.
Dave Smart is one of the best coaches in the world, and now you can learn from him with never before available access. 3 all-access practices and 1 defensive coaching clinic are available at davesmartbasketball.com. What makes these all-access practice and clinic videos so unique? Dave Smart has won 12 national championships and has a winning percentage of 92%. Dave Smart's Force Weak Hand defensive system is world-renowned and has never been shared in this way before. Dave Smart has a winning record in over 50 games versus NCAA Division I teams, having beaten Wichita State, Baylor, Wisconsin, and many others. Dave Smart is recognized by Jay Wright, Mick Cronin, Jay Triano, and many other top coaches in the world as one of the best minds in basketball. Learn from one of the greatest minds in the game who opened his doors and shared the game with us from one of the most successful basketball programs in the world. Go to davesmartbasketball.com now to learn more and to purchase all 4 videos.
It still amazes me. And honestly, it's one of the reasons that I've had success in sharing what I share, because it's just, I think when I first started sharing some of these ideas about pedagogy in particular, that I just assumed people knew. And then people don't know what they don't know, but I quickly learned that most people, yeah. I don't know why, as you said, sport's been exempt to this about advancing how we teach. Not necessarily what we teach, but that's changed too, but just how we teach. And even in the NBA, some of the organizations I've been able to observe, I haven't seen it to the extent that it probably deserves to be. So it's great.
Light bulb for me was watching when I was in Philadelphia, I would spend time at some different schools around town. I'm really inspired by Chip Kelly and the things that he was doing with the Eagles, where he was having practices graded by teachers and he was having, you know, drills graded by local elite teachers. And of course the coaches lost their mind. They were like, what is this person going to tell me about this? You know, how my defensive backs are supposed to turn their hips or track the ball. And, you know, Chip's point, which I thought was the totally right one, was, yeah, you're not going to tell them about English, but that's content. Like, American history is content. How you manage a classroom, how you deliver that content, like, that's teaching. And so that transformed the way I thought about, okay, what is our, you know, approach? Like, what are the modes that we're transmitting this information to our players? What's the best way we can, based on our resources, to try to consider ideas that are being applied in tougher teaching environments than we have? You know, like, can we flip the classroom? Can we create small groups within this? Can we create more games-based learning? And if not, like, why not? And can we change something to allow for that? Because if we do, we're going to get the iterative benefit of all the days we have together get us pointed closer to what we're after. And if we choose not to do it that way, then we've got a drag, you know, our rudder's not all the way in the water. So, I think it's something that we're all, of course, questing to try to do it better. And I find myself slipping into old ways of thinking all the time and being like, oh man, like our players will lose their mind if we try to give them a quiz. But I think that doesn't mean that's not the right thing to do. And I think trying to consider, do I have the resources to deliver this consistently and professionally? And if so, then you should be doing it.
Well, and players should operate, in theory, players should operate in their own self-interest in improving. And to a certain extent, obviously, that's your job to sell them on that reality, that all I'm doing is trying to help you get better. And this is something that helps you get better. But it's still amazing, the resistance from something that is non-traditional, but is based on evidence and research and all these other things. And that's really a selling point. But I imagine it's not just players too. I imagine administrators, clearly someone on the street, or, you know, really, again, you can get criticized for doing it different than what's traditionally been done if it doesn't work.
Well, and you can criticize yourself, right? Like,
of course,
not just the energy to create a different kind of film session or a different kind of practice. It's also my confidence level in delivering it. So if I need help to do those things and I'm not confident that I can get everyone, if I can teach them the why and teach them to be excited about it and convince all of my staff, okay, or whoever I need to help me execute this thing, then it's not a good use of time. And our players are going to feel that. And they're going to say, why are we doing this way when this other way works fine? And they're right. And so I think you need to have I certainly have a strong litmus test for things that are new, because Henry Iba did all sorts of smart shit. We should not think that we need to be all that different to, you know, he was like 70% of the way there. And maybe as a sport now we're like 82% of the way there. But if we're looking for edges and we're looking for little advantages that we can add up, and those advantages add up, they multiply over time. They don't just become small benefits. They can create the sort of snowball that you see in the New England Patriots or the San Antonio Spurs or the Hawthorne Hawks, you know, like those things. That's what we're after. And that's the only way that you try to separate yourself from your opponents. But that doesn't mean that you should come into the year trying to change everything from, you know, go to whoa. It means that if you're going to make a change, you need to make sure that it's one that you can make effectively and that you can do a good job at, so that you keep the belief of the players and that you don't. And there's something that I think about from my time spent with David Martin, who's our head of sports science with the Sixers and worked with Australia Cycling forever. And cyclists, you know, they're on the road 200 plus days a year and they're carrying multiple bicycles and they've got all kinds of crazy sorts of logistics to manage. And logistical fatigue is such a real thing in their sport that figuring out how to get through an airport, flying obviously commercial, you know, in Italy and then in China and then in Australia and then in the San Francisco Bay, like thought that goes into that. Like thought goes into what the meal looks like. And if it's something new and delicious, that probably ain't worth it, because that is going to take more, you know, it's the cereal aisle where you're trying to make choices, and that takes away energy from what you need to do. And, you know, everyone, I think, points out, oh, 82 games, wow, it's amazing, you know. And it is, until you learn about NHL hockey or cycling, and then you're like, wow, it's not quite as amazing. Like, that seems hard, materially harder. And so the job, if you're the decision maker, the job is to say, all right, this intervention is worth the time and energy, and we're going to do it from the start of the year, and we're going to make it the normal, and we're not going to bounce around from thing to thing just trying to make incremental gains and running the risk of screwing things up too often.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff, Coach. And I love how deeply you've thought about it. And I think, again, that's all I'm trying to do as well, is just stimulate people's thinking about some of this stuff. But let's jump. I mean, we're so lucky to have you here, and I want to get into some technical tactical as well. So I don't know how to approach this best, but let's start with this, because I know we can go anywhere. Your experiences coaching at the national team level with Australia, with Coach Lemonez, what are some things technically, tactically that you brought back to coaching in the G League or with the Nets or wherever you were at that particular time? Are there some specific things that really stood out that you brought back to your coaching, technically and tactically?
I think the use of time, the compressed kind of realities of a campaign, you know, where you link up on August the 2nd and everybody's coming from their own environments. And on September 1st, you play the first of three games that are going to determine in large part whether or not your country gets to go to the Olympics. That is a Herculean task and requires a lot of editing, you know, which is one of the most underrated skills, I think, in coaching. It's like, all right, we got 15 training days and, you know, maybe five lead up games. So let's work backwards. Like, what do we need to have in by the time we get to that first game? And then what can we get in during that first game or in between the first and the second game with only one day off? Like, yeah, for me, it always starts with the physical. Like, all right, how can we deliver the players to a court where they feel fit and confident and rested and ready to perform? And so working within those confines, probably need an out-of-bounds play or two, probably need some sets to call, probably need some offensive concepts to understand, and same thing on the other end. Like, what do we think we're going to face? And so if we think that first team is going to post it a bunch, let's make sure we spend some time on that in the preceding weeks. But using those kind of constraints, I think, really helps inform, is the right place to start for me in any season. And so you do the same thing with training camp, you do the same thing with the off-season, you know, the all-star break, like, all right, I got 7 days. Like, what do I want to spend time on? That, I think, Andre has done a masterful job at with different groups. So, you know, this year we'll have quite a few NBA guys, some of which have never been a part of our program, or it's been a few years since they've played together. You know, the real Olympics being the last meaningful big tournament that these guys were eligible for because of the schedule. And then you've got guys that have been a part of every window, you know, the Nick Kays of the world, that Mitch McCarron's, you know, those guys have carried the load, and they have a role to play in helping us get ready. And if they make the team, which they surely might, that will benefit from their familiarity with everything that's going on. But if they don't make the team, we'll benefit from having them in camp, and they'll add a bunch to the quality because they're more comfortable with the terminology. And we need to change. Like, we're the ones that need to adjust, not the players. So we need to understand what environments they're coming from. And we've been studying how they've played during their club seasons, be it in Anadolu Efes or the Cleveland Cavaliers. And we're trying to offer up to them the chance to say, hey, look, you know, this is stuff that we did that I think would be really good for me, or really good for Delly, or really good for Ben. So I think in all those ways, you can probably hear maybe the appreciation I have for him more than any individual idea. But I think he's just a master at saying, yep, all right, 2 weeks to get ready to play Canada and Lithuania for our lives. No worries. Here we go.
Easy.
No dramas.
Hey, the good thing is at the time of this recording, Canada finally decided who's coaching it. So that's good. Coach, maybe let's go through let me start with this. So you're going to go coach the Sydney Kings. How are you deciding the style of play? Is that somewhat predetermined based on your experiences and your philosophy? Or is it going to be more directed by who's on the roster and as you go through this roster formation? What are the most important factors for you in deciding style of play?
Heavily tilted towards the latter. You know, Andrew Bogut is on your team. It's pretty clear how you should play defensively, I think. Like, you shouldn't, you know, Andrew shouldn't be blitzing. And so it's not like it's easy, but it is simple. Like, it is kind of, I think, clear that there's going to be a way to play defensively that suits his talents. And he's an extreme example because he's such an elite rim protector, such an elite defensive rebounder. on the other end, such a good screen setter, such a good passer, like all those things lead you to some answers. And then you go sign Casper Ware and, you know, a few of these guys returning, Kevin Lish, Brad Newley, Dan Kickert, guys that were on the team last year, and the picture gets filled in more and more. And so I don't think that there's, you know, 100 styles that work, but I think that there are enough styles that work that you can, that more often than not, starting with the players and thinking through like, all right, how do they look good? Like where, you know, who's done a good job of helping them look good in the past? And what can we do to do the same thing? I remember Steven Jackson had a great quote one time about Don Nelson and just talking about the universe of players, professional players is, okay, maybe there's, you know, 50 or 60 NBA players that are just so damn good that you can't really compare, and, you know, kind of the bell curve idea, right? And then there's that big fat little section where there's surely more than 350 some odd people in addition to that that could fill in those spots. But so much of the difference is the belief in the strengths of the player and the opportunity and the way that that player is positioned to be successful as a role player. And so, you know, you start with the guys that you know are going to play 80, 90% of the game minutes, and then you try to make sure that other guys are put in position around that to be successful. And I try to spend a lot more time thinking about what people are good at rather than what their weaknesses are, because I just think that there's, if you get to the level of play at the NBL, like, you got plenty to offer. You got lots of good aspects to your game. So it's my job to try to help show those off.
Yeah, no, and that's it. I mean, to focus on what they can do is such an important part of that process. And Coach, maybe let's just jump into a little bit of your background, but it's relative to what's something you took away from each of these people, because you've just had great experiences and great mentors through the way. But let's start with Rick Barnes at Texas. What's something that is practical you learned from him that could help coaches?
I think that he was, you know, when I joined that program, it was already so established and has just come off an Elite Eight run with LaMarcus Aldridge and Daniel Gibson and PJ Tucker. And they had seven freshmen coming in and really talented set of guys. You know, we're all really excited about that. But the talk at that time was all about, did we just lose our culture? Did we just lose the thing that we had, you know, with this mass exodus, what threats does that present to our program? And then on the flip side, what opportunities are there to change? And so that first year, he went out and spent a bunch of time with Mike D'Antoni, and we played a style offensively that was really fun, really fast, really aggressive. And we weren't very good because we had seven freshmen, and we had the unanimous player of the year in Kevin Durant, and we still got our ass kicked in the first round, I think it was the first round, USC. And so that was a real education, his approach to having a new set of players, taking advantage of that to change stylistically and add some things into the program and breathe some fresh life into his kind of offensive coaching. And knowing that the dividends of that may not pay off in that first year, but the following year after Kevin left, we made it back to the Elite Eight, you know, with a bunch of sophomores, and we're able to, you know, we ran up against a buzzsaw in Memphis, but we had one of the best years in program history. And I think it was because of the decisions and the approach was taken in that time, that off season after LaMarcus and those guys left and before Kevin and DJ and Justin, those guys arrived.
Yeah, that's great. How about Sam Hinkie?
Sam's probably the best decision maker I've ever been around. Someone that works with an end in mind, and there's probably, you know, enough written about the way he went about, I think, organizing one of the most impressive rebuilds in NBA history. But more than that, him as a family man, him as a mentor, him as a husband, in our conversations, I've now essentially eliminated basketball from the things that I'm dying to ask him about, because I just have so much appreciation and thirst for learning what he knows as a dad of four and as someone that applies the same kind of rigorous approach to looking for a house for them to live as he would to look for a trade to execute. He's just one of the funniest and nicest people in basketball. And because he's a private person, it probably doesn't get shared with the outside world very much. But the friends of mine that I've been able to introduce him to, and the time he takes to have coffees with people at Summer League, and his generosity and trying to be a mentor to people and share his time, I think is easily in the 99th percentile in our business. And that's something that I will have more long lasting effect maybe than anything I learned strategically or tactically from any of the other folks I work with.
No, that's great to hear. Great to hear that impact. Brett Brown.
Such a energetic and motivated leader. His communication with the players, his communication with the media, with our ownership, like such an incredible ability to connect and not bend contort himself into being anybody other than he is, but is surely one of the most gifted communicators I've ever seen. And there's 100 things that I could list that I stole from him, but you know, the notes to himself after watching every game that he would let me have organized for him, and you'd see on there like, what a dumbass call. Like, why are you calling this? Like, you know, all caps, like, you did this again? Like, you know, this play sucks. Like, that kind of self-critical approach, I think, is in such demand in our sport for sure. And on the flip side, like, his real interest for the world, you know, he had the opportunity to live and make a whole life in Australia and travel all over the world. And very often one of the first things he'd do with new players is go to Google Earth, which he thought was the coolest. You know, he's 55 going on 75. Like, he just, technology, he loves it. And so he'd pull up Google Earth and watch it spin around and find this little town in Croatia where, you know, Dario spent a lot of his time growing up. And that was something that he was always excited to do. But, you know, I also saw it for what it was, which was a really clever way to connect with somebody and make those first interactions memorable and personal and separate from, okay, Dario, now we're going to need you to work on your shooting the threes. So let's, I think he had the right kind of approach with players, and the time he spent with them in his office and the time he spent texting them at night, that is a big part of what modern coaching is in my mind.
Yeah, no, it's great. And that reconnects back to the word human, which you used earlier, is that you're coaching humans. So Kenny Atkinson.
I think he sees the game better than any coach I've worked with. And I think it's largely due to just deliberate practice on his calendar. You know, like, he has a routine. He exercises religiously. He wakes up super early. He blocks off time for what's most important to him. And that's studying. You know, I think that studying the game and getting a plan for the day based on what's gone on practice wise or in a game last night. And I think he's identified processes that work for him to do all that and get a nap in the early afternoon and be ready to hang out with his kids some when they get home from school and go to bed early and wake up early and do it all over again. So you just, again, see an example of someone adding up those good days to where when he watches a game, he says, God, this is happening a lot. Like, this closeout situation, I'm just seeing it again and again and again and again. Maybe our individual vitamin should look like that, right? Like, what, you know, he's bringing that to a coach's meeting and saying, fellas, are we appreciating how often our guys are trying to defend in this closeout situation? And what are we doing in our work to reflect that? And so often, you know, terrible loss, we all feel like crap. And at 6 a.m, he's marching around the facility saying, we played fucking good. Like, that was like, we just got crazy unlucky.
Yeah.
Talk about a great realization to have. And the flip side, right? Like, lots of wins that we didn't deserve. And so being able to see stuff for what it is, I think, as important in a leadership role as almost anything else you could find. And again, an appreciation for a way for him to influence and interact with that culture buzzword, team dinners, staff dinners, events, you know, things that are fun, things that are different, like limitlessly interested in those things, thirsty for those things. And in combination with Sean Marks, you know, I think that we had as good an environment in pro basketball as you could hope to have. And from the family room to the training camps that we'd spend at the Naval Academy to the flag football games we'd play instead of practice someday, like all those things, I think added up and created a place where guys enjoyed. And because there was so much attention paid to their individual development, I think guys really appreciated the fact that, all right, you know, win, loss, draw, like I'm going to get better today. And that's going to help me in the long run. And that's going to help our team in the long run.
I've heard that, like, about the individual development piece, but what does that actually mean at the NBA level? Does that mean more one-on-one attention with a coach, more video sessions? What does that actually mean when we talk about that you do a team organization does a great job with individual development?
So the way we talk about it often is like holistic development. And I think that for us, that meant somewhat horses for courses, you know, that Jacques Vaughn and Caris LeVert's time is going to look different than Jared Allen and Brett Brielmeyer's time, which is going to look different from Spencer Dinwiddie and Adam Harrington's time. And that each of those coaches were trusted with the job to take complete ownership's not the right word, engage fully with the player and say, you know, back to what we talked about earlier, like, what is your North Star? Like, what do you, you know, where do you believe you can get to? And what do you think is going to be important? And develop a relationship to where you could say, Spencer, you're full of shit. Like, that is not going to be a shot you're going to shoot in the NBA. So, like, why would we waste time? I know you want to shoot it, but you shouldn't. And if we have a relationship where I can share my evidence and beliefs about that with you, then you hope to build enough trust that you can create a dialogue and a back and forth that says, all right, well, given where, how many minutes you're playing and what this next week looks like today, we should spend time shooting free throws or playing one-on-one or having a coffee or watching a bunch of film. And I think unless you give autonomy to the coaches to do that, you're missing out, I think, on the way that players can improve, because they need to feel like there's someone who's watching every minute they play and they is experiencing things in the heated intensity of the highest level of the game. And if they feel that way, I think they're more likely to trust what the organization's doing. And I think that it gives the head coach a chance to intervene when he wants to intervene or when he needs to intervene, and creates another layer for coaching staff to say, all right, well, Will, you're spending a ton of time with Milton Doyle. Like, why is he playing so bad? Why do you think he's playing so good? Can other guys learn from what he's doing? I think that's the heart of it.
It's a great answer and a great insight into the understanding of what that means in terms of development at that level. So Andre Lemonez, and maybe a lot of coaches aren't as familiar just because there's North American slant, but a coach that's done it all really at the international level. So coach, what are some things you took away from him?
Yeah. Three back-to-back-to-back championships in the NBL in the 2000s with the New Zealand Breakers, longtime member of that program, built it up over time, was the head coach, full-time head coach of the Australian national team for the 4-year cycle preceding Rio, now is head coach of the Brisbane Bullets and serves as head coach in part-time environment, has sort of adopted a David Blatt type old Maccabi flow offense that has changed and influenced a whole generation of Australians. The league, you know, it's as common as the flex was back in the day, or, you know, the shuffle before that with the coach Gaze and, you know, the things that went on there. So really has been responsible for kind of laying the groundwork for Australian basketball over the last decade, and because of the style of play that he has and because of the style of leadership he shows. So I think that I've probably learned, my personality might be the most similar to Andre as compared to some of the other guys that I've worked with. And so that's been a real opportunity for me to project myself onto him, you know, try to see the style that he uses to engage with players, to try to stay out of their way when he needs to, and the humility that he shows in that kind of environment, and the times that calls for him to stand up and stand directly in the path of the team and say, you're going the wrong way, boys, like turn around. Like, this ain't the way to do it. I think that's one aspect that I'm really appreciative of is seeing how he is a mild mannered person and is someone who's was an accountant in his previous life. And so I think that the natural charisma that Brett has and the sort of energy that he brings is something that I certainly learned a lot from, but is not as authentic to who I am as watching someone like Andre operate and lead a team and grow a culture. So technically I think the flexibility, you know, you got 3 weeks to prepare, you got a week to prepare and your best player won't be healthy. You got a whole new set of guys, you got FIBA windows that are going to be a week long that you just show up and you play 2 days later. That is, I think, actually a really fun approach and one that you have to enjoy, but it's also, I think a lot of coaches wouldn't be able to handle it, much less thrive in it. And again, it all comes back to, I think, his intellect, his humility, his approach that has let him be successful and helped us as a group be successful over the last, you know, two cycles.
It's great to hear, Coach. And again, so many insightful things that you shared throughout the podcast. And Coach, maybe the last one, let's Will Weaver. What have you learned from Will Weaver over the years?
Less and less.
Well, you're obviously someone who's studied, or you're obviously someone who, I'm assuming, depth of note-taking, depth of analysis, depth of thinking, which I value tremendously. So, you know, where, I guess, has your growth been the most in terms of a coach over the years?
You're nice to say all that. Those are things I want to be. And of course, we all have imposter syndrome to a degree about the opportunity that we've been able to find ourselves in. And I think that if anything, it's, you know, the conversation I had with myself leading into college where I wasn't a good basketball player. I didn't have connections that helped me understand the landscape of coaching, but I sort of identified the things I really cared about and the things that I wanted to try to make my life about. And that was trying to do something that I thought was positive, or at worst neutral for the world, that if there wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to benefit from the misery of others kind of thing. Something where I could be a family man and that I could have a wife and family and children and do that well. And something that was competitive. I felt like the energy I got out of that environment was something that I wanted to cultivate and chase. And that led me to sports and led me to coaching and put me in positions to benefit from the generosity of mentors along the way. And there's no reasonable explanation for why I get to coach a professional basketball team other than all kinds of luck. And the only thing that created the lucky environments that I've benefited from was that intention early on and trying to stay focused on those things as time's gone on. And so the not losing sight of that, despite the distractions of visa applications and, you know, apartments in a foreign currency and trying to sign a couple more imports, you know, that's, I think, the task for me in the short term. And I think it probably will reflects a similar set of tasks for me in the future as well.
Well, speaking on behalf of me and the audience, I think we're all looking forward to seeing how your journey unfolds. And we know we'll be hearing about you again, whether it's a continued success wherever you are in Australia or when you move back here. So Coach, I'm very appreciative. Thanks for taking time and sharing the game with us.
Thank you so much. I hope you and your esteemed listeners will come visit us sometime in Sydney. We hope to do some interesting stuff. And anybody that wants to bring a athletic wing or foreman that can shoot the ball down to Sydney, they can stay at my house.
I'm not sure about the athletic wing, but I will definitely take you up on the offer and coming. So I love
Deal.
That. So,
take care,
Coach.
Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to basketballimmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.